So what I want to talk about this evening is the topic of intelligent design. This is something that I'm sure you've read about in the paper. I mean, Kansas has been in the news. Pennsylvania, Dover, Pennsylvania school system has been in the news. Some people have been trying to teach intelligent design at public schools. So what I want to do is talk about what is intelligent design? What do we mean by it? And I'm going to try and make it as simple as possible because it really is a very simple concept. If I show you this picture and I say this picture here can be explained by one of three phenomena. Either this picture on the mountain, Mount Rushmore, as you'll recognize, came through chance. I mean, rain just fell on the face of the rock, and just the way the rain came down and the winds, the angle that the winds came at the rock, that's the result. It just happened. Anybody believe that? No takers. One taker. Okay. Necessity. And by necessity, I mean it's a law of nature. It's a natural law. Okay, if I drop a ball from here, and what's going to happen to it? It's going to fall. That's a law of nature, the law of gravity. So by necessity, if rain falls on limestone rock, you're going to get these four faces cut into the face of the rock. That's just a law of nature. Any hands for that? No takers. The third explanation is somebody designed those faces and cut them into the rock face. Any believers? Great. That's the concept. Look at anything. Anything I show you. It's either happened by chance, it's because of a law of nature, or it was designed. And that's what the concept is all about. So first of all, let's get into some definitions. What is it? I want to talk a little bit about the history of intelligent design. Who are the key movers and shakers behind this movement? And then I want to introduce two concepts. And these sounds like the two concepts sounds like very large words or phrases: irreducible complexity or specified complexity. Intelligent design can be explained by those two concepts, and I'll talk about what I mean by that. And then I want to talk about how do you test for complexity? How do you test whether something is complex? Talk a little bit about arguments for a designer, some more examples of design. I'm going to show a few very simple examples up front, and then we'll cover a few more examples after that. And then how does intelligent design relate to creationism? You know, most of you in the audience here believe in creation as explained in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. That's how God created the world. That's how God created us. That's what we believe. Intelligent design, how does it relate to that? So first of all, what is intelligent design? And here's a definition that people like to use. So the theory of intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. Okay, that's a simple definition of intelligent design. The leaders, and this is important to note, the leaders in the intelligent design movement purposely do not equate the intelligent cause or the intelligent designer with God. And they do that on purpose. They're agnostic on the issue of the age of the earth, of the age of the universe. In fact, some intelligent designers, as you'll see, even believe that perhaps evolution was a mechanism for how we got here. But nevertheless, they believe that there's an intelligent design mechanism. I want to explain the difference between creationism, scientific creationism, and intelligent design. And when I talk about scientific creationism, I'm talking from a biblical perspective where, you know, we think as creationists that God created the world 6 to 10,000 years ago, that kind of a time frame. There is a sudden creation of the universe, energy, and life from nothing. Mutations and natural selection lack the ability to develop all kinds of living kinds from a single organism. We just don't think that can happen. Changes of the originally created kinds of plants and animals occur. There are changes that do occur, as we'll talk about tomorrow when we talk about the icons of evolution, that occur within fixed limits. In other words, there are some environmental changes in our environment on our Earth that allow certain changes within living organisms. There is a separate ancestry for humans and apes. And again, we'll talk more about that tomorrow when we talk about icons of evolution. Earth's geology can be explained by catastrophism, primarily by the occurrence of a worldwide flood. We believe that the worldwide flood explains a lot of things that we see on Earth today. Intelligent design, those two concepts, specified complexity and irreducible complexity, are reliable indications of design. And I'll explain what we mean by that in a bit. Biological systems, that's living organisms, such as you and I and animals and plants, exhibit specified complexity and use irreducibly complex subsystems. Naturalistic mechanisms or undirected causes do not suffice to explain the origin of complexity as we see in life today. Intelligent design constitutes the best explanation for the origin of specified complexity and irreducible complexity in biological systems. What evidence for design do we have? What do we see in the universe, in the Earth, in living organisms? Well, in the cosmology, evidence suggests that the universe, including all matter, space, time, energy, came suddenly into existence a finite time ago, contradicting the picture of an eternal and self-existing material cosmos, which is what some would believe in. Physics gives us evidence, has shown that the universe is finely tuned for the existence of life, suggesting the work, as astrophysicist Fred Hoyle puts it, of our super intellect. There's just no other way to explain the fact that there's so many finely tuned constants in the universe that we depend on for life and for existence. Two other ones. Biology, the presence of complex and functionally integrated machines has cast doubt on Darwinian mechanisms of self-assembly. Remember, when Darwin came up with his theory of evolution, he knew nothing about the cell structure. He knew nothing about DNA. And so he was flying blind in a bit. I imagine if he saw what we see today in biology, I think we might get him to change his mind. Molecular biology, the presence of information encoded along the DNA molecule has suggested the activity of a prior designing intelligence. Remember, DNA and RNA, that explains how living organisms exist and how they reproduce. Darwin knew nothing about that at that level. He couldn't see that at that point, but we can see that now. And yet, when we see all that, when evolutionists see all that, we still have scientists, Harvard scientists, for example, saying, like Lutonen, you need to embrace a materialism that is absolute and to stick with material explanations no matter how counterintuitive. Just like Barry was saying, ignore the data, go with a theory. It's the same kind of thing. History of intelligent design. You know, there is a modern intelligent design movement led by Philip Johnson, who is actually a lawyer, not a scientist, as we'll see in a bit. But intelligent design has been with us for a while. Even some of the Greek philosophers believed that there must have been some designer because they couldn't explain the complexity of things that they saw either. Even some early church fathers in the 3rd and 4th centuries, they believed, obviously, in the Creator, in God the Creator, and they believed in intelligent design. One of the good books that came out in the early 1800s by William Paley, who was a natural theologian, he said, if I walked through a field and I saw a watch laying on the ground, would I think that that watch just sort of happened to be there? It just, you know, just as if I walked through a field and I saw a stone laying in the field. You know, if I saw a stone, I believe, well, maybe somehow it got washed up there. But if I saw a watch, I couldn't believe that it just sort of happened. There has to be some design. There has to be a purposeful designer behind that. And that was some of the, you know, the thinking back in the early 1800s. And here's what he actually said, you know, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he said, you know, in crossing the heath, if I pitched my foot against a stone and asked how did the stone come to be there, well, it is just there. I mean, I don't need a very complicated explanation to say why it's there. But if I came across a watch on the ground in the same place, I'd have to ask some questions. You know, how did it get there? It just didn't happen. You know, it was designed and placed there or lost there by somebody. It was put together for a purpose. There was a purpose for that. Modern intelligent design, you know, we run across names like Charles Thaxton back in the 1980s, Walter Bradley, Michael Denton, Dean Kenyon, and Philip Johnson. These are people, scientists, some of them, theologians, lawyers, some of them, who questioned the theory of evolution. They aren't all believers, but they can see from a scientific point of view that the theory of evolution has gotten something wrong. It just doesn't click. I mean, the data doesn't match the theory, if you will, like Barry was talking earlier this evening. Philip Johnson is, like I said, a lawyer. And he took, I believe he took a sabbatical and studied evolution for a year and tried to suggest, you know, what if I took this into a court and ask a jury to decide? I'm going to present all the evidence. Jury, you tell me, is evolution true according to the facts? And so from a legal perspective, he asked those questions. And his answer was that Darwinism is hopelessly entangled with naturalism. It's just tied in with naturalism, and the facts just don't support that. Other key movers in the intelligent design movement, Michael Behe, who introduced the concept of irreducible complexity, William Dembski, who introduced the idea of specified complexity, Stephen Meyer, Paul Nelson, and Jonathan Wells, three others, very instrumental in the intelligent design movement. Here are some books that these scientists, theologians, lawyers wrote. Okay, going back to Thaxton back in 1984, 22 years ago, even Michael Denton, who is not a believer, but he said, you know, the theory of evolution is in trouble. It's got a crisis. It just doesn't hang together. And then Philip Johnson came out with his book, Darwin on Trial. And that's really the book that started that whole, the whole modern intelligent design movement. Others, the creation hypothesis, Reason in the Balance, again by Philip Johnson, Michael Behe's book on Darwin's Black Box, which I'll talk about, The Design Inference by William Dembski, which I'll talk about a little bit more as well. So these were some very influential books. And the one that started, Philip Johnson asked the question, can evolution be proved in the courtroom? From a lawyer's perspective, could I prove that evolution is true? Do the facts support the theory? And he wrote that book in 1991, and he concluded the facts do not support the theory. And that started a whole discussion going. Another book by Philip Johnson, The Creation Hypothesis, and it's actually a number of different writers in this book, The Creation Hypothesis, philosophers, physicists, astronomers, chemists, biologists, linguists, critique Darwinism and promoted intelligent design. So it's just not Johnson, the lawyer. It's a whole bunch of different scientists from different fields. And so he got this movement going, and they called together a conference of people of like mind, at Biola University. And these authors that I show here, Michael Behe, David Berlinski, Philip Johnson, Hugh Ross, and others, these are some of the prime participants in that conference. And as a result, they wrote some more books on intelligent design. Okay, here's one, Darwin's Black Box. Okay, this is one that was written by Michael Behe, who's a professor of biochemistry at Leahy University back in 1996. And his book was so convincing that people no longer argued with his, they only argued with his conclusions, not his facts. The facts that he presented, the concepts that he presented were quite believable, even to doubting evolutionists. So they didn't argue with his they argued with his conclusions, but not the facts that he presented. Okay, that's a little slow here. Okay, so his... get a sync here. Okay, irreducible complexity. He introduced this concept in his book, Darwin's Black Box. He says something is irreducibly complex if it is composed of two or more necessary parts. And by necessary, he means that all these parts are required for this thing to function. Remove one part, and the function is not just impaired, but it is destroyed. A mousetrap. He gives the example of a mousetrap. It is irreducibly complex. And what he means by this is that you can build a mousetrap from five major parts, as shown here. The hammer, the spring, the holding bar, the platform, and the catch. You can't build it by natural selection. And in fact, you need all five of those parts to function as a mousetrap. If I just use four of those parts, would that mousetrap work? I don't think so. You need all five of them. So that's what we mean by the concept of irreducibly complex. And here's his explanation. Okay, the wooden platform as the base, the metal hammer that crushes the mouse, a spring with extended ends to power the hammer, a catch that releases the spring, a metal bar that connects to the catch and holds the hammer back. So as he says, you can't just catch a mouse with a platform and then you add a spring and maybe catch a few more mice that way. No, you need all five parts to be in place to catch any mice at all. So by irreducibly complex, what he means is a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease function. An irreducibly complex system cannot be produced directly by slight successive modifications of a precursor system, because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. It just doesn't work. You need everything. And so that's just a mousetrap, five parts. And we'll talk about the human cell and some other complex organisms later on, which consists of millions of parts. Okay. So, with this as a background, Behe and Johnson began speaking, debating on major universities. They began writing articles, editorials for the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and other major media. They appeared on different shows and got the word out. So that's irreducible complexity. The second one is specified complexity, and that was introduced by William Dembski, who has a doctorate in philosophy, math and divinity, quite a combination of doctorates. And so he wrote a book called The Design Inference. Okay, and that introduced the notion or the concept of specified complexity. 1999, if you remember, 7 years ago, you know, there's a huge debate in Kansas about teaching against evolution, or at least being able to talk about things that refute evolution. In other words, if you look closely at the theory of evolution, you'll find that the facts don't really match that theory. And so should the students be told about the fact that those facts don't match? Okay, when somebody proposed doing that, you know, the educational system just reacts, overreacts. They don't want you to question their theory of evolution. And I would say, if the theory of evolution is so solid, why would you care if I challenge you? If it's solid, I'm not going to be able to find any holes in it. So what are you worried about, right? So, but nevertheless, they take that very personally, and they don't take it very kindly to that. So Johnson, Behe, Dembski, and others started publishing widely. They wrote a large number of books, as you've seen there in that list I gave you, and start to expose the naturalistic bias of science and of the media who reports on science. I mean, you've seen it in the media yourself. The way they, you know, if somebody just challenges evolution, they jump all over you. Okay, the last, Darwinists only repeat, if you challenge them, they'll come back and say, you're just presenting a religious argument. Intelligent design is nothing but, you know, creationism in different clothes, if you will. And, you know, we can show you, well, I can show you here that it's totally different. And yet they will use that argument. It's just another religious argument is what they're saying. William Dembski here, a little bit more. He published his book on intelligent design, major conferences held, and the word is starting to get out, a lot more attention on what's happening in Kansas. Philip Johnson comes out with the seminal book called The Wedge of Truth, and what that is his explanation of, you know, we got to plant the seeds of truth here in the educational system and then gradually work our way into the system. You know, once people start to question evolution, and, you know, you just work your way into it, it's the wedge of truth. Another important book that came out in 2000 was called The Icons of Evolution. And an icon, as you know, is a picture of something that we see in the media, whether it's on TV, on books, you know, what have you. But if you see that icon every day in your textbook, you're going to start to believe that's probably true. This is such an icon, the icon on that book. And tomorrow evening, we're going to talk about what those icons really mean, what's behind those icons. So the little bit more about the intelligent design theory. If you look at living organisms, and again, you have to realize that Darwin couldn't see any of this. I mean, he didn't have the microscope that he could look at cells, at living cells. He didn't know what made up a human cell. You know, the millions of different components, the proteins, actual motors within your cell, as we'll show in a bit here, he didn't see any of that. And if you look at the contents of a human cell or any living cell, you'll say, that's just too complicated to just sort of happen. And when you take the concept of irreducible complexity and specified complexity, and if you need all those components of a cell to work, you can't just build that one step at a time. You need all those pieces. So how did it get there? So living organisms are too complicated to be the result of natural processes working independently. Intelligent design based largely on the theories underlying information theory. We're not going to get into information theory here, but that's a whole new area to explore. And there are various creation scientists exploring that whole area of information theory. So intelligent design is concerned with measuring the complexity of structures and information contained in structures. Generally concerned with those two principles that I talked about before, irreducible complexity and specified complexity. Let's talk a little bit about what we mean by specified complexity or specific complexity. The following two strings of characters illustrate this concept. Considering the following, the first string of characters I have in quotes there. Can anybody make any sense out of that sentence? Is that some language that somebody knows here that can interpret that for us? I don't think so. So yet, those characters are complex. You have to agree they're complex, but they're not specified. They're unspecified. You know, there's no information in there that's useful to us. Take the second sentence, the state of education in America. Is that complex? Yeah. That's got all those characters in a line there. Is it specified? Yes. It means something to us. We can make sense out of it. So that is specified complexity. Okay? So remember that concept. There's a difference between unspecified complexity and specified complexity. So intelligent design takes intelligence to be a separate principle that is not reducible to chance and necessity. I'm going to bring you back to the first picture of Mount Rushmore, which I said happened either by chance, by necessity or law, or by design, one of those three. And that's what intelligent design is all about, that third concept. Intelligent design certainly targets evolution. There's no question about that. It says life exhibits a special kind of order, not like that of a snowflake, but like that of a meaningful message. And by a snowflake, you know, if you take chance, necessity or law or order, and you take design, those three concepts, a snowflake is the second one. You know, a snowflake doesn't have to be designed. In fact, it's not designed. Every snowflake is different. But there is certain laws and orders that snowflake follows. Depends what temperature it freezes at, depends what material it has available, but there's a certain order to that snowflake. Intelligent design can also be considered sophisticated anti-evolutionism. There's no Bible thumping involved. There's no concept of the designer is God, the God of the Bible, and it's philosophical. ID is a separate principle, and here again, just pictorial, you know, the three different concepts. Chance, dice, I mean, you associate dice with chance, right? You associate a formula on the left here, F equals G, M1, M2, over the distance between them. That's, you know, the force proportion to the mass and over R squared, the distance between the two objects. So that's a law of gravity, a law of gravitation. That's necessity or a law. And then third is design. If I show you this on the right, didn't happen by chance. It didn't happen because some law said that's how it's going to be produced. If I pour, you know, some liquid into some container, that's going to turn out that way. No, it's designed that way. So those three principles. So just to summarize, irreducible complexity introduced by Michael Behe in his book, Darwin's Black Box. Specified complexity introduced by Dembski. Okay, and there are a whole bunch of books come out, and you know, you've all heard the phrase, no such thing as a free lunch. Well, there is no free lunch. I mean, there has to be an explanation. Something, if you see some phenomena, it's got to be explained by one of three mechanisms. Chance, a law, a natural law, or design. So a lot more books were published, and I won't get into all that. Dembski's claims were publicized as both designed artifacts and organisms exhibit special order, specified complexity. Okay, remember those two concepts, specified complexity and irreducible complexity. And specified complexity doesn't apply just to artifacts that you see, things that we make, airplanes, if Boeing airplane, for example, or a car. It also applies to living organisms. Chance and necessity cannot generate specified complexity or information. Intelligence is a separate principle, a separate concept. You have to keep it separate. Blind mechanisms like those of Darwinian evolution cannot explain life. So then, how do you detect if something is complex? How can you detect specified complexity? And again, if you look at this on the right, all those letters thrown together, again, that's complex. Okay? And those are letters that you recognize. But I don't think anybody can read that sentence or sentences there or make sense of it. There's no useful information there. So it's not specified complexity there. So contingency. I mean, all kinds of characters can appear on a page of paper. Complexity, it's improbable to obtain by pure chance. I mean, I could probably type some gibberish on a piece of paper that's unrecognizable quite easily just by typing at random on a typewriter. Okay, but if I type a meaningful sentence and I do it randomly on a typewriter, I intend to write a meaningful sentence, I can't do it on a typewriter. Specification, it can't read but fits properties of a language that's known priorly. DNA is a code. RNA is a code for replication of living mechanisms. Those are predefined. Those are specified complexity, examples of specified complexity. Testing for design. So I look at that gibberish that I showed you in the previous slide, and I say, does that follow some law? In other words, if I type randomly, that has to appear because of the typewriter I'm using, or just because of, you know, my fingers really are ordered, they're not random like they appear to be? No. It doesn't follow some law. So then, does it happen by chance? Okay, third, is it by design? So whatever you put in, you've got to put through this filter. You say, is it contingency? Is it necessary? Is it a law? Is it a chance thing? Or if it's not, then it has to be design. And so we can take you through the filter that William Dembski came up with. He came up with what he called a explanatory filter. Starting here, with whatever you start with, you ask the question, is this highly probable? In other words, if I drop an apple, if I hold an apple here and let go, is it probably going to fall? Highly probable, yes. It will always fall. Okay, there's no known exception to that rule, to that law of gravity. So it always falls, so it's highly probable. Okay, take something else of intermediate probability. You know, it could happen, it might not happen. And, you know, you throw a dice. Will 6 come up sometimes? Yes. Will 5 come up sometimes? Yes. You know, highly probable. One out of 6 times that you throw the dice. What do you call that? You call that chance. Okay. What if I take that same dice, for example, and throw it 1,000 times, and it always comes up 6? What would you say? It's a loaded dice or something. You know, it's not real, right? It's not a real dice. But if I show you something like a cell under a microscope and show you the complexity of that living organism, okay, what will you say? Could that happen by chance? Nope, not in your life. Is it destined by law, some natural law, to produce that? If I take some proteins and put them all together, can I produce a living organism? I don't think so. So here you have the filter. You just ask the questions. You know, is it highly probable? Is it intermediate probability? Or is it very, very low, small probability, or in fact, zero probability? Then it's got to be designed. Okay? So that's what they call Dembski's filter, checking for specified complexity. If I show you a pattern, this is just a pattern 16 by 16, okay, 16 by 16 squares, and I've colored the squares, you know, some blue and some orange. Does that look like something of some kind of a design there? Does that look like this, some figure you can recognize there? I don't think so. I don't think you can make much sense out of that. So this, in fact, you look at the probability, 2, you know, every square can be either blue or orange, and you say you take 16 by 16, that's 256, every square can be either blue or orange. So the probability of this particular pattern is 8.6 times 10 to the minus 78. In other words, almost zero. The probability of me getting this particular pattern, if I wanted to produce this pattern randomly, is zero. No chance. However, if you look at this pattern, right? Anybody recognize that? Smiley face? Okay. Was that produced by chance? Was that produced by some law? Because if I colored it, it would automatically appear that way? No. That's design. I designed it to come up as a smiley face that people could recognize. And the probability of that is the same, right? The probability of this here particular design is small. And so we say that is designed. It was designed that way. There's no way it could have just happened. So we have arguments for a designer. If you look at a living organisms, it could look designed for at least three reasons. It has some redundant mechanisms. And I know hopefully nobody here has had a heart bypass, but I have some friends who have had some heart bypasses. And I'm amazed that they can just take arteries out of their legs and out of other parts of the body and replace the arteries around the heart. How can they do that? Your body is designed with a lot of redundancy into it. You know, it's designed with redundancy. It just doesn't happen that way. It's designed with redundancy. So that requires a designer. Excess potential. And by that we mean that people have potential that you may not recognize. And we have the example here of some primitive people. You know, we might not think that somebody in the bush could possibly do calculus. Can you do calculus? Well, you used to be able to do calculus, right, when back in school. And you could learn it again, right? Bush people can actually learn to do calculus as well. They have excess potential. They have information, they have a brain that functions that could do some quite complex things. Complexity. Life exhibits a kind of complexity that is hard to produce by processes involving chance. And when you look at the probability of that, and we're not going to do that here, I will do that a little bit in my workshop tomorrow afternoon when I talk about science vindicates God's word. And we're going to look at the two different models, models of creation, models of evolution, set these things up, look at 10 different areas of science, and say, does the evidence fit creationism or does the evidence fit evolution? In other words, do the facts fit this theory or do the facts fit that theory? And we're going to take you through 10 different areas of science. And complexity is one of them. You know, the probability of life starting from non-life, what's the probability? Well, we'll take you through that, what we mean by that. So that's an argument for a designer. Oh, I'm sorry, that didn't show right away there. Okay. So those are three things I just talked about. I'll give you a second there to read that. And then you take design and deductive reasoning. In general, arguments for a designer are arguments against the alternative. You talked about those three different concepts. If it's designed, it's not by chance. This does not mean these are just arguments against evolutionary theory. All arguments, by definition, are characterized by taking one side while arguing against another side. Okay, arguments against a theory are about eliminating possible explanations. There's nothing inferior about this. In fact, it's a deductive reasoning which is used by science all the time in their quest for truth. Talk about the likely and the unlikely. Arguments for a designer. Meaningful complexity is unlikely to result from random events. And, you know, we often look at the human eye and look at the complexity of the eye. I mean, just think about, you know, I can't rattle off all the features of the eye, but the, you know, the fact that your eye blinks so many times per second and it's well-oiled and it can adjust to light and to darkness, it can see far, it can see close. I mean, all of these phenomenal things that your human eye can do and do for all the, you know, the 90 years or however long we live, it's remarkable. That just didn't happen by chance. And as we'll see, even Darwin questioned that, you know, the human eye. Science is about predicting what is likely and what is unlikely. Everyone is in agreement that the events leading to production of living organisms are unlikely. Okay, the eye is a prime example of something that we believe there is no chance of that having happened by evolution. Evolutionists will argue, you know, just give me enough time. Give me enough time and evolution will happen. I'll just show you. Just, you know, billions of years. And yet, when we look at some of the probabilities of things happening with huge amounts of time, as we'll look at the probabilities tomorrow in the workshop, again, we'll see that the probability of something happening over a long period of time is still zero, still zero. Dawkins, who is a well-known British evolutionist, he still says that while life looks designed, the designer was not God, but massive chance coupled with natural selection. Nature was the designer. You know, he's got the same facts that we do. And yet he draws different conclusions. Stephen Gould, another famous American evolutionist, he wrote a book called The Panda's Thumb. And he said, you know, if you looked at panda's thumb, you say, what a poor design. How could a god design a panda's thumb that looked like that? And in fact, some people would say, how could, if God designed your eye, how could he have done it? I mean, it's, there are things that don't look right. But when you think about them, it really was designed in a very phenomenal way. And so people have argued against Stephen Gould and shown that he's just plain wrong in that. Okay, little or big changes. Not all changes improve fitness. They may improve the fitness of an organism, very unlikely. They may be neutral, or they may be detrimental. In other words, decreasing an organism's fitness, and that's most likely. You know, mutations can be either good, they can be bad, or indifferent. And it turns out most mutations are, in fact, bad. They're harmful. Only 1 in 1,000 mutations are good, beneficial. And, you know, for evolution to work, most mutations need to be beneficial. So Darwin argued that evolution is the accumulation of many small changes that improve fitness. Big changes are unlikely to result in improved fitness. Many large groups of facts are intelligible only on the principle that species have been evolved by very small steps. And he talks about that in his book, The Origin of Species, Chapter 7, under Reasons for Disbelieving in Great and Abrupt modifications. He believes things have to happen in very, very small steps. So how do you get the human eye? Okay, he just couldn't explain that. So here's some more examples. I talked about the snowflake. The snowflake is an example of necessity or law or order. In other words, snowflakes, you know, snowflakes are different from each other. But they're produced under some very well-defined natural laws, depending on the temperature, depending on the ingredients, and a whole bunch of factors. Crystals, the salt crystal, rock crystals, quartz rock crystals. You know, they are very well-defined, and they will be produced because of their nature of their chemical bonding and things like that. And so those are examples of necessity. They are not. They don't have to be designed. I don't have to design a salt crystal. Okay, the salt crystal will be formed according to the chemical bonding laws that they adhere to. But then, if I look at an animal cell, and I show here an animal cell to the right at the bottom, there are millions of components in that animal cell, in our cells, in any other animal cell. So they are all, they have to be designed. When you look at the probability of all those things coming together, you look at the concept of irreducible complexity, specified complexity, there's no other way to explain it but by design. Some other things here, the molecular motors, human eye, and bombardier beetle. And let me just walk through those quickly. The cell that I showed you there before, some kinds of these cells actually have little motors made up of proteins, and those motors actually rotate. Some of those motors rotate at like 100,000 times a minute. Huge. You know, how does that work? Those things are going around in your body there somewhere, you know. How does that work? Did that just sort of, you know, grow by chance, happen by chance? I don't think so. And this is an example that Behe used in his book. You know, these molecular motors, or protein motors, if you will, can only be explained by irreducible complexity. There's an example of them there. Okay, there are over 100 molecular motors that are known to exist within the cell. And if you look at people can look at, the science can look at these under a microscope. And they can see those parts. So, just to summarize, Michael Behe says, if we look at these protein machines that run cells, there is a point at which no parts can be removed or still have a functioning machine. He called those machines irreducibly complex. In other words, I can't remove any of those parts and still have it work. And I can't just start with, you know, some of those parts and hope the other parts will be added to it. It just doesn't work that way. So we see these irreducibly complex items in our life all the time. And we, you know, we looked at the mousetrap before, so let's not spend more time on that. Let me talk a little bit more about the eye. And Darwin was honest enough to have a chapter in his book called, you know, Difficulties of the Theory of Evolution. You know, here are some problems I see with the theory of evolution. One of the problems that he saw was, you know, the fossil record. At the time when he wrote the book, 1859, he knew that the fossil record did not support his theory. And tomorrow we'll look at that when we talk about the icons of evolution. You know, that is one of the biggest holes in the theory of evolution still. But he also recognized the eye. Organs of extreme perfection and complication. He said, in his words, to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, for the correcting of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. So he had a problem explaining the evolution of the eye. But his answer was, to go from nothing to an eye would be a big jump. So he said, what he did is proposed a series of what appeared to be relatively small steps, and yet it turns out they're still large steps, that would be able to produce an eye. And, you know, this is just five different steps, but there are many, would it be many, many steps involved. And so what is the purpose of the item on the very left there? What's the function? Why would that just appear if it didn't have any function? If it's, you know, it has to be irreducibly complex. The eye doesn't function with all its parts. here's an interesting one. Some of you may know about this extraordinary beetle, the bombardier beetle. And it attacks its enemies by combusting two liquids within its internal structures and bringing them together. And when they come together, they actually explode. And the bombardier beetle excretes that and points it to its enemy. And it can actually have a frog, you know, turn away and not attack it. Is that powerful, the explosion from his internal organs? And yet, if those two fluids are combined in the body accidentally, he'd explode, right? So how does this happen by chance? I mean, if your parent tries to combine these two things and your parent explodes, well, evolution doesn't work very well, right? There's no offspring from that. So how could this evolve one step at a time? Now, it's got to be programmed into the beetle's DNA for that to work. So bring this to a conclusion. You know, intelligent design uses this explanatory filter that I showed you. You know, you ask the question, did this have to happen? Is there some law that makes that happen? No. Did it happen by chance or by accident? No. Well, then it has to have happened by design. And that requires an intelligent agent to cause that to happen. ID theory focuses on what is designed without answering the questions of who, when, why, and how. It doesn't say who is the intelligent agent, who is the intelligent designer. It just says that was designed. And some observations about intelligent design, because as creationist, you know, it is complementary. I consider it complementary to creationism, but it's not a replacement for creationism. It competes with evolution, but not with creationism. However, you have to recognize that intelligent design, ID, confronts naturalistic philosophical underpinnings of evolutionary thinking. It identifies the presuppositions of naturalism. It is supported by science, as we've seen. ID does not assume a young universe. It is not creationism. It's not a replacement for creationism. It does not mention the fall in Genesis 3:15. Does not attempt to explain all designs. Only certain features are designed. Does not rule out evolutionary processes even. Although, when you look at it closely, I don't see how the evolutionary processes could coexist with intelligent design. It does not oppose an old age for the earth. It does not acknowledge God as the Redeemer. It does not distance itself from the problem of evil. It does not identify the designer or the creator. And it divorces the creator from creation. Is it an alternative to Darwinian evolution? Yes. Is it an alternative to creationism? I think it's more complementary. It's not a replacement for creationism. Should it be taught in public schools? I don't think it's ready for that. although, you know, that doesn't mean we can't question evolutionism. We should be able to, you know, as free thinking, as critical thinking individuals, we should be able to question, you know, any scientific theory, including evolution. You know, I've had it said that a Chinese scientist came to the States, this is probably a number of years ago, and said, in our country, you know, we can't question our government, but we can question evolution. In your country, you can question your government, but you can't question evolution. I find that quite ironic. So we need critical thinking. We need to be able to think through these issues. And we need to teach our children how to think through those issues. Presuppositions must be stated. Evolutionists have presuppositions. We as creationists have presuppositions. Okay? We all look at the same facts. Creationists, creation scientists, evolution scientists, they all see the same facts. I mean, you look at this room, you see the same chairs, the tables, people. You know, we all see the same facts. That's not the question. It's our presuppositions that are different. Is this a church-state issue? No. It's just simple, scientific, critical thinking. Academic freedom is what is at stake. You know, we shouldn't brainwash our children, shall I say. We should have them think freely and figure it out and tell them that there's, you know, theories have problems. And particularly the theory of evolution has a problem. Kansas, you know, there's a lot of controversies in the state of Kansas, as you probably know, about what can be taught in the schools and what not. Kansas standards say there is a lack of evidence or natural explanation for the genetic code. In other words, evolution doesn't explain the genetic code. Fossil records are inconsistent with evolutionary theory, and I'll show that tomorrow when I talk about the icons of evolution. And say certain evolutionary explanations often reflect inferences from indirect or circumstantial evidence. In other words, they don't have the facts to support evolution, and yet evolution is still taught. So, just to summarize, intelligent design theory, if it looks designed, guess what? It probably is designed. If you can't explain it by some natural law, you can't explain it by chance, it's probably designed.